You know, Lake Superior has long been considered to be the cleanest of our Great Lakes, but today we're going to be talking about how some intense storms might have affected the quality of that lake. Larry Mueller here with my guest by phone today, Matt Hudson. He's the Associate Director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation, housed at Northland College in Ashland, a wonderful college. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit, too, as we go along here today. So what comes to mind when you think about Lake Superior? What do you want to know about the relationship between the extreme weather and water quality? Love to have you part of the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Matt Hudson, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Larry. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you with us today. Well, let's start by sharing how this report came about relating to Lake Superior.
Sure, yeah. So the group that I work for here at Northland College, called we call it the Burke Center for short, is focused on science and communications. And so we do a lot of work up in this region to try to understand water quality conditions. And then we work with undergraduate students as part of their education here. And then a big focus of our work is trying to provide ways to better ways to communicate the science to help inform better policy decisions. And so what we did this fall is the International Joint Commission, which is a body that works on transboundary water issues between the United States and Canada, was holding a series of listening sessions across the Great Lakes, and they wanted to come to Ashland to learn a little bit more about water quality issues in Lake Superior, and in particularly this part of Lake Superior. So we hosted them for a day-long session of briefings where we had a number of science experts from the region come talk about water quality issues that are of pertinence to the sort of the Wisconsin southern shore of Lake Superior. And then in the evening, there was a public input session at Northland College where we had about 200 people come and talk about their concerns for water quality in Lake Superior and the Great Lakes as a whole. And so our effort to summarize that, we wanted to sort of create a snapshot in time of what we learned in that particular day, what the messages were from the public and also from the science experts about what water quality issues are right now, so that that can both inform, hopefully, current decisions about improving water quality, and also we can take a look back in the future and see what the issues were at this point in time. So the white paper or the publication that we put out is intended to be that summary, and it's intended to also create some more awareness about water quality issues in this part of Lake Superior. Lake Superior often isn't thought of as having many water quality issues.
Right.
And then we all... So, yeah, I guess I can leave it there.
Well, and you mentioned the South Shore, and that's what? How many miles of shoreline are we talking about from where to where?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, roughly from the Duluth area on over to up into the Keweenaw Peninsula in Michigan, a little bit towards Houghton. So, you know, maybe 100, 150 miles or so of shoreline seems to be this area that has been particularly affected by large storm events in the past few years.
Yeah. You know, Phyllis in the town of Dunn has a comment. Let's go to Phyllis for a minute here. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. So I just wanted to let people know that Lake Superior is facing a huge peril, and that's from Enbridge's Line 5, which needs to be shut down. A portion of it runs through the Bad River Reservation, which is up there by Ashland County, and it crosses the Bad River, which runs into Lake Superior. And some members of the tribe found way back in the woods, 50 feet of pipeline is now exposed to the elements, to rocks, to trees, to all kinds of things that could damage it. And so that makes the likelihood of a rupture much worse. And then 28 feet of those 50 feet are actually unsupported by soil because the soil has just eroded out from under them. So that's just one huge danger that could happen any time. There's another one. There's a meander, which is like, you know, sort of like if you imagine a shoulder, neck, head, back to the neck, and so that tiny little neck is like an isthmus. And the pipeline goes right through there, and the water has only to go through 25 more feet. It's gradually just eating away at that neck of land. And when it goes through, there'll be, it'll probably be during a big storm, and there could be huge pressure and rocks and so on, and it could break it there, too. So
no, problems there. Are those, thank you for calling, Phyllis. Are those kinds of issues part of the whole process here, part of the water quality issue?
Mm-hmm.
Matt?
Yeah. That was certainly an issue that came up a number of times, both during the day with the science briefings and then, you know, when the public input session we had later on that evening. That was certainly an issue on a lot of people's minds up here. It's sort of the one of the current issues that's at the forefront of our of the public's interest in Lake Superior water quality issues. So it was something that the IJC definitely heard a lot of from folks in this region is having a concern about pipeline and the potential for oil spills being an issue in this particular region of Lake Superior.
Well, in summary, what were your findings in summary?
Sure,
I'm talking about the report now, of course.
Mm-hmm, right. No, so I think one of the big things is that, you know, there's a lot of speculation, I guess, that the recent storm events that we've had in this region that have been, you know, we hear the terms 100-year, 500-year, 1,000-year storm events, these large sort of unprecedented storm events that this region has experienced in 2012, 2016, and 2018. And so they've sort of they've exposed a number of issues for us, including a lot of the infrastructure in our region is significantly undersized to be able to pass the water that's falling on the landscape and running through the stream. So we've seen a lot of infrastructure damage to roads and bridges, culverts. Also our wastewater treatment infrastructure is also being exposed as being severely undersized. And this isn't just a problem here in our region, but many, many other places as well where we have very old wastewater treatment infrastructure and we experience sanitary sewer overflows. So that's been happening more frequently in our region with these large storm events. Another potential outcome of these events has been the emergence of blue-green algae blooms in Lake Superior, in particular, you know, around the Apostle Islands, which is perhaps the most shocking thing that has come out of these recent events that has caught people's attention. So, those are some of the big things that were highlighted quite a bit.
Yeah, we can talk some more about that. Pat in Duluth has something for us. Pat, hello.
Hi. We've lived in Duluth since 91, and usually the lake was always crystal clear, you know, all year. And the last few years, it's not unusual for it to be covered like a muddy color. And that starts at Superior Duluth and is now up the shore a bit. And I just wondered if you could comment on that. I mean, I know some of our rivers in Duluth, and I think one in Superior, are kind of eroding on the sides, and so you do see that as muddy now. But I just wanted, I'm sure you're aware of it, but it's something that's so noticeable right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great point. I think, you know, these events have really also brought a lot of attention to the sediment or the clay that has always been, you know, a big part of the local geology of our region. During spring runoff and large storm events in the past, folks that live in the Duluth area with the Nemadji River running out there and in the Ashland area with Fish Creek and other streams flowing into Schwamigan Bay, the water often turns a sort of a reddish-brown color. But the extent of those plumes of sediment that are entering Lake Superior has been noticeably larger. In fact, satellite images from space following some of these large storm events have really illustrated just the magnitude of the amount of sediment that our streams are carrying into Lake Superior. And so the size of the rain events and the water that's being carried down these streams is enormous. And so along with that, the amount of sediment that we're seeing delivered to the lake is also larger than what we've seen in the past, and so at least in the recent past, and so that's also potentially something that's leading to some of the blooms that we've been seeing as well.
Yeah, and along with Pat, what Pat had to say, David from Rensselaer, Minnesota, emailed that he had a question about the Nemadji River that flows from Minnesota. It contributes to a large amount of clay silt. And can or should that be mitigated, or is there even a way to mitigate it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So that's one of the largest, it is the largest non-point source pollution issue up in our region is sort of excess sedimentation. And, you know, I always make the point that, you know, our region has all these beautiful coastal wetland areas. We think about the Bad River, Cocagan Sloughs, Fish Creek Sloughs, all these waterfall areas and beautiful coastal lagoons that are a result of our natural geology that has a lot of sediment has been carried down these streams in our region, like the Nemadji and Fish Creek, since the glaciers receded. So it's not that this is not a natural thing to our region, to the geology of our region, but our land use practices, particularly related to the forest cutover from 100 or so years ago, and the damage that caused to our local watersheds has exacerbated or increased the amount of sediment that we see coming out of those streams. And so there are a number of efforts. There's been various agencies and groups that have looked at this problem for years, since the 50s for sure, when there was the Red Clay Interagency Task Force up in our region. But in more recent times, there's been focus on, you know, what can we do to reduce the rate of surface runoff from upland areas that can help reduce the amount of power the stream has to erode and generate all that sediment that we see. So I can talk more about that if people want to, you know, about some of the efforts that are ongoing as we try to mitigate some of that sediment getting into the lake.
Well, it's one of the many issues. Those algae blooms, there were some pretty enormous ones.
Well, the one in 2018 was the one that caught the attention of the New York Times, and it was really extensive from Superior all the way up to, for those familiar, the Cornucopia region, Myers Beach, so kind of where the ice caves and the sea caves, that region of the lake, that whole shoreline was affected by a bloom for a number of days in August of 2018. And so that was the one that's been the most extensive to date, and certainly the one that's caught the most attention.
Yeah, for sure. Matt Hudson, our guest today, he is the Associate Director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation, located at Northland College in Ashland. We're talking with him about the Lake Superior report that was done, and talking about the lake itself with him. And he's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today, so you can join in with your questions and comments as we move along. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us your question or comment to ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Matt Hudson. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the relationship between extreme weather and water quality as it relates to Lake Superior and the vulnerability of Lake Superior water due to more severe storms. And they contribute to erosion, infrastructure damage, algae blooms. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Our guest, Matt Hudson, is the Associate Director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation. Works out of Northland College in Ashland, and with us to talk about that report and about Lake Superior. Certainly, you can join in with your own questions, comments, experiences at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jane in Ashland has something for us, Matt, so let's go there. Jane, hello. Thanks for calling.
This is Jan.
Oh, Jan. Sorry, yeah. Jan.
Okay, that's okay. Yeah, I'm a landowner in Ashland County, and living in an area that was has been heavily impacted by the flooding and heavy water, heavy rains and snows. I mean, I'm looking at snow right now. Our roads have suffered. We had State Highway 13 washed out in two places in my community. And now we have Enbridge approaching us saying that they want to put lines right through this area. We have just a very highly complex hydrogeology. The impacts of these heavy rains have been, as I say, significant. And as a previous caller stated, in terms of the washouts of the line that is existing right now in the Bad River Reservation, with large areas exposed, it seems ridiculous to think that it would be okay to put a line through the reroute area that they're talking about. It doesn't make sense. We have, some of the best waters in Wisconsin, some of the highest quality waters, and the watershed, if anyone would pull up a map of the waters, I mean, it's just a meshwork of rivers and streams and wetlands and springs that are spontaneously coming out of the ground. I'm deeply concerned, as are many of my neighbors, about the Enbridge's permitting process, which has now begun. They filed last week. And the entire watershed is threatened, and, of course, everything goes into Lake Superior.
Yeah. Well, Matt, a comment from you?
Sure, yeah. Hi, Jan. The Enbridge, again, that issue certainly came up a lot during our event with the IJC, and it's certainly on the minds of a lot of folks right now. And kind of related to that is sort of the, beyond pipelines, just talking about roads and road infrastructure or maybe like a sanitary sewer pipe, how big should we make these things now? Like, what's the new normal we should expect? Given the sort of uncertain reality that we seem to have gone into in this region, it's really a challenge for those who are concerned about water quality, just wondering, whether it's a good idea to do certain things like, the pipeline reroute, or just physically, how do we, design a bridge or a culvert that'll be big enough that's not going to, wash out in the next large storm event that we have. So it's really creating a lot of challenges for folks that, design infrastructure, the funding for these kind of things, the resources is obviously always limited. So, the conversations about water quality and larger projects, not just, Enbridge, we've also had a lot of other proposals in our region that have drawn a lot of attention in recent years, the iron mine in the Pinoki region and a large hog farm that came up a few years ago. So there's a number of sort of larger scale developments in our region that have caught the attention of folks and that are concerned about water quality. And that certainly overlaps with the increase in storm events and storm intensity and how we go about any kind of developments like this in our region that, in a good way.
And the problem is, or one of the problems is, these storm events, we don't know, are these going to continue? Are they going to get worse? And then how do you plan for something if you're not quite, if you don't have reliable data or a long enough history of data on what's been happening over the last few years?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And so, we don't know if we've kind of entered a new normal. There's a number of folks in this region that as we enter 2020 here, all these large storm events we've had in 2012, 16, and 18 have happened in even years. So we're wondering if 2020 will be we'll have another one of these in our region. It's a great question. And there's always the limitation of resources, and there's. There's that, the region we're in is generally a poorer area of the state. The median household income in the Ashland region is, about 30% lower than the state average. And so, you know, in our region, but other places of the entire country, it's a major issue, just funding for infrastructure, much less larger infrastructure than we have maybe built in the past. So I think it's a big question that we have to struggle with, and certainly people need to talk to their legislators about.
Jan, thanks again. Jerry in Menominee will give you a chance. Hi, Jerry. Oh, we lost Jerry. He had a question about that you may have answered, because his question related to the heavy rains and the pollution that is caused. Are these, you know, these intense storms, they are relatively new, as you say. What was the 2012, 2014, 2018, somewhere like that?
Yeah, they are. We certainly always had, you know, large events in this region, and I think what the National Weather Service data is showing for the Ashland region in particular is that we have seen more rain in our region than since the middle of the 20th century, for instance. So that's actual, you know, measured data. But another thing we've also seen is an increase in the intensity of the rain. So if you receive 5 inches of rain over 24 hours, that's going to have a different impact on the landscape than 5 inches of rain in 1 hour. So the rate at which it comes down and the kind of soil that we have in our region, which is heavy clay content, which doesn't allow a lot of water to infiltrate, and a lot more runs off. So that increase in intensity of storms that we seem to have seen in the last few years is where we see a lot of these large flood events and infrastructure washouts.
And this extreme weather pattern isn't really even unique to Lake Superior, is it?
Certainly not. There's stories from all over the world, really, but other parts of Wisconsin, down more in your neck of the woods and the western part of the state that are struggling. And there's been a number of conversations across the state about flood events and how we build sort of or talk about a more resilient future, and how do we respond to what seems like a lot of changes in our weather patterns.
We were talking earlier about the rivers, and you were mentioning that there is a lot of ongoing work, and at least to mitigate some of the problems associated with rivers dumping clay and so forth, other materials into the lake. What's going on there?
Yeah, so we're fortunate in the Lake Superior Basin, and of course over in the Lake Michigan Basin, Wisconsin, there's the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is the large federal investment of money into the Great Lakes to restore and improve the Great Lakes. And so we, in the Ashland region, we've certainly had access, or at least the ability to apply for those funds. And there's been a number of different things that have happened, but the kind of the mantra of resource managers in our area is this term called slow the flow. So basically, the idea is that if we can reduce the rate of water running off the landscape, particularly in the headwater areas of streams, that will reduce the amount of erosion that the stream can cause further downstream and less sediment in the lake ultimately. So I helped to lead a project that just concluded last year where we worked with a number of partners in the region, federal and county, state, and it was a really great project that involved working with a lot of private landowners in the headwaters of Fish Creek, which is the largest tributary to the Shawmigan Bay of Lake Superior, which is where Ashland is located. And so those folks, we worked with them to install wetlands, or constructed wetlands on their property to capture some of that water and hold it back from getting into the larger Fish Creek. And then we also worked in Fish Creek itself. There's a number of large eroding stream banks or bluffs where a lot of the sediment is actually coming from. And so we worked with a number of partners to stabilize one of those large bluffs. And so it's kind of a watershed scale look at trying to hold water back in the headwaters and then reduce sediment within the stream and one or two projects isn't necessarily going to be the solution, but the hope is to be able to do more of this work moving forward, and you know, ultimately have more of a larger impact on the landscape.
Yeah. Well, Shane in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Shane. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. And Professor, I know, Larry, you've definitely had more than a few shows about some of the invasive species in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I was curious what maybe poses the greatest threat to Lake Superior. I'm not as familiar with it as I am Lake Michigan or even many of our lakes in Central and South. And on top of that, in the news, there's been an ongoing discussion about PFAS. I wanted to know how that's maybe translated in Superior, if it's still a real risk up there. So those are my questions.
All right, Shane, thank you so much. Matt, comments?
Yeah, thanks, Shane. So, you know, you mentioned invasive species, and that is certainly, you know, a large issue all across the Great Lakes and beyond. Lake Superior is fortunate to be still, you know, it's the largest and coldest, deepest of the Great Lakes, and the fact that it's so cold and deep has prevented some of the invasive species that have really ravaged some of the lower Great Lakes. I'm thinking quagga mussels and zebra mussels, things like that. They are present in Lake Superior, but they don't have quite the same foothold here. There's certainly concern about, as water temperatures continue to rise, as our climate changes, that the lake could become more hospitable to things like zebra mussels. And so there's always concern from, you know, in the Duluth Superior region is the largest port in the Great Lakes often, and that's an area where invasive species have come into Lake Superior in the past. And so there's, you know, they are present in the lake, and there's certainly a concern, but maybe not quite to the same level in terms of impacts as we've seen in some of the other Great Lakes. And then he mentioned PFAS. You know, that is certainly an emerging issue. You know, it's been in the scientific community for quite a number of years. I think it's getting out into the public mind in recent years. And it's something that, you know, we don't have a whole lot of information about, in particular, like, you know, drinking water from Lake Superior or groundwater in the region. I think that's something that needs, you know, a lot more study in our region. And microplastics is something that's also we're sort of at the beginning ends of understanding that in our region and how that might affect water quality and human health. So I would say those are, you know, more emerging issues. And those, you know, those came up occasionally during our event with the IJC as well.
Shane, thanks very much for calling. Another listener who couldn't stay on wanted you to talk some more about red clay and its effects on Lake Superior water quality. Could you elaborate a little more on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the most obvious thing is that, you know, visually you can see it for anyone who's been up here to, you know, after a rain event or in the spring. The Schwamigan Bay in particular gets very reddish in color, and that can linger for quite a long time. And you know, I think the potential link between the blue-green algae blooms and the clay is that, you know, there's so much of that gets entered into the water, you know, when we have these large events. And there's a lot of there's also a lot of something called phosphorus, which is really important for algae growth, as you know. And so as we get more of that coming in the water associated with the sediment, there's concern about that contributing to more algae blooms in the future, along with warmer water temperatures. So there's a number of factors that create the right conditions for those blooms. At the same time, the clay to some extent helps to block light, which help, you know, is plants and algae need light in order to be able to grow. So, you know, there might be some sort of a mitigating factor on the clay, kind of blocking out some light and preventing some blooms that might otherwise occur. We're not exactly sure how that mechanism completely works at this point. So yeah, and then of course the folks that live in this region, the water, the bay, the Lake Superior is really important to the economy up here, and And when we have those large extended plumes of red clay in the water, it really impacts people's ability to use the resource the way they want to, swim in it, boat in it, fishing, that kind of stuff. So more extended periods of time with dirty water or red water as opposed to clear water is something that we're concerned about, affecting the economy in this region.
Yeah, for sure. Someone else wondered about past land use practices, things that we've done in the past up in that region that may have impacts on this, or maybe changes in land use patterns or land use practices that would have impacted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, our landscape in this part of Lake Superior is very unique. Where Ashland actually sits at the bottom of Glacial Lake Duluth, precursor to Lake Superior, so that's where a lot of our clay comes from. And then the old beach shoreline of Glacial Lake Duluth, where that interacts with the clay, it's just really naturally susceptible to erosion. And then, during the cutover, the forests were removed from the landscape in this region, late 1800s, early 1900s. And if you think about it, the forest functions as sort of a sponge to help soak up water when it's raining or when snow's melting. And when you remove that sponge from the landscape, the water just rushes off the land that much more quickly, creating a lot more erosion and sedimentation. So we still see effects from that cutover on our streams today, and a lot of our sediment that we see coming into the lake, while a lot of it is, would naturally be there as part of just the way our geology is around here, a lot of it can be attributed back to the cutover, and also, current land use practices and roads and things like that affect it as well. But certainly the cutover, the legacy of that, we still feel the effects of that in our region today.
Yeah. If you're a landowner or a homeowner sitting in that area and you look out, you see the sort of these massive acreages of clay in the water, you wonder, well, what could anything that I could do make any difference at all in this? And what can people do on their own property, though, that could make it, I guess it all helps, right?
Sure. I think we worked with a number of landowners, with that project I mentioned earlier. I think part of it's finding multiple benefits, things like putting a wetland on your property. Maybe somebody has an interest in reducing sediment to Lake Superior, but maybe they also have an interest in having more wildlife, having more ducks, having more deer, or creating, giving some of their land back to nature. There's a wide variety of reasons that folks might want to do something like put a wetland in on their property that could also benefit Lake Superior. And so I think those things that can have more immediate benefits for folks in terms of, whatever their values are, that can also benefit a larger issue like improving the quality of water in Lake Superior or, perhaps fishing within Fish Creek, for instance. When we have those sort of win-win situations, I think it makes it easier for folks to sign on to things like that. And so when we can paint a picture like that, I think we can have more success in implementing conservation on the land.
And what about getting more involved with organizations and maybe research focused on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I that's one thing we hope to continue to do more of here at the Berg Center is create opportunities like we did this fall for people who live in this area to come out and express their concerns. And also, the IJC is basically the commissioners that are appointed to serve on that are appointed by the President of the United States and the Prime Minister in Canada. So basically folks had an opportunity to be one step away from the leaders of their countries there and express their concerns. So I think providing forums where folks can feel like their voice is being heard is one thing we can do. And then we're also, hoping to, through our programs, generates the next generation of leaders within the water science and communication and education. And so both young people and students that come to Northland College, or students that aren't here yet that want to come here, or folks that are in our region that Just want to learn more about water quality issues in our region. These are all things that we, you know, hope to be able to provide more of moving forward.
Well, you do some great work up there, Matt, and Northland College is a great college. I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. And you can find out more. Just go to Northland College, I assume, and online?
Yes, or people could you know, type in the Burke Center, Northland College, and there's the white paper that I've been talking about is available there, as well as a 5-minute video that highlights and summarizes a lot of the work that occurred with that white paper.
Yeah. Matt, hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Larry.
Matt Hudson, Associate Director at the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. Great talking with him. Hope we'll get a chance to talk with him again. Tomorrow on the show, we talk home improvements, do's and don'ts of winter home care with John Freiberger. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.